Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Gamification sounds like it's just about fun and games, and it is to a certain degree, but it's also big business. Joining us now to talk about what it is, what it does, and why you should care is Rob Bessinger. He is Director of Research for Mindset Digital in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Rob.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So, all right, what is gamification?
Well, I like to think back to, you know, Mary Poppins and how she used, you know, playing a game to clean up the room, to get the kids to clean up the room. It's taking that idea and stretching it out for bigger purposes. So it's really using game theory, anything that involves points and, you know, competition and so forth for bigger purposes. So you find hospitals using it to teach medicine or to get patients to do things. You get see businesses doing it to try and get people to become clients and all sorts of other reasons.
One analyst has projected that 50% of corporate innovation will be gamified, all these new words, right, by 2015. Why has it been applied to business? When did that take off, where it wasn't just a spoonful of sugar to get a couple of lazy kids to clean their room anymore? It's bigger than that.
I don't know if I can put an actual date on it, but it seems in the past year and a half, it's really become a buzzword. And there's still some skepticism whether it's being overhyped. But it's clear that, especially in healthcare and some other fields, it's a big area where hospitals think that they can make a difference.
So give me an example of the healthcare use of it.
Sure. So the Mayo Clinic, one of the most prestigious hospitals in the country, did some research a few years ago to determine that there were too many transfusions going on. And transfusions, while they sound like a good thing, if you do them inappropriately or if you do them too often, can lead to bad results, including death, but infection and a whole series of other kind of adverse results. So partly what they've done is they created an iPad app called Transfuse that was basically a game simulation where doctors and other medical professionals could determine in a realistic but not real situation, is this a good time to do a transfusion or not? And you gain points if you give a right answer, and you don't get points if you get the wrong answer. And what they've seen is as they distributed the app, transfusions have gone down. So that's a good example of using it for a learning outcome where maybe you wouldn't get someone's attention to read a paper about transfusion and when is the appropriate time and when is not. But it put people in the situation, allowed them to play a game, and it became a bit of a fun thing as well as a learning opportunity.
It's the interactiveness, too.
Yes, very much so.
They have to do something.
Very much.
To learn. What about patients? What sort of gamification has been employed to help patients?
Well, that's happened in a whole series of fields. You've seen it happen with things like, there are a lot of cases where someone is required to record, say, what they ate all day, or kids are required to report how much they exercised all day. And the problem with that sort of research is that you can never really count on how accurate the recording is. So there are a lot of different apps that have been used to try and encourage people to gain points as they do those activities, and it encourages them to do things, and doctors end up with better medical records.
I read a pretty poignant story about a little girl in England who found out when she was 7 years old that she was diabetic and would be for the rest of her life, and had to start four times a day pricking her finger and testing her blood. And she was appalled by this. It was just a little girl. And they made it a game, some kind of game to make her earn points every time she did it, and that kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's really interesting because you would think, some of this is more obvious when dealing with children, that you could make a simple game and change their behavior, basically. But you even see it, in kind of serious adult, very adult situations. There's a company called Blue Marble that created a game working with the Department of Defense that's designed to help people with traumatic brain injuries. So we're talking about soldiers coming back from war.
Mm-hmm. And traumatic brain injuries is a huge problem.
Sure. For all the people who have been near blasts of explosives of different sorts. So partly what Blue Marble has done is created a game where it's a simulation game and the players are on an island and there are a whole series of tasks that they need to do. For instance, picking berries from a bush. So Blue Marble programs in butterflies to fly by. They really have nothing to do with the game. But someone who suffered a brain injury is more likely to be distracted by something like the butterflies. So it tracks their actions. And if the person playing the game tries to reach out and do something with the butterflies, it records that. So it's a way of monitoring where they stand. And the game is really, you know, very medically based. So they're looking for particular cognitive behaviors. But it is part of the treatment now for soldiers coming back from war.
If they could turn Cubis into something productive for me, I would really appreciate it. What about businesses trying to attract business? How does it work there?
Well, one example we like to talk about is by a company called CenturyLink. People may know them better as Quest, the big communications company. So Quest had this problem. They're the number three communications company, well behind AT&T and Verizon. They don't have the kind of money to advertise themselves to get clients the way the big giants do. So they created a game called Ultimate Problem Solver, which is basically a trivia game that people play online. It asks 50 questions. The questions get harder as you go along. And mixed in there are questions that are clearly designed to teach you something about who they are, you know, where are their offices, that sort of thing. And also questions designed to get you to spill a little of your information. And what they found over time was tens of thousands of people played Ultimate Problem Solver. The only reward you get is you get your name on a leaderboard. And they ended up with thousands of business leads of people who might want to sign up for communications. And what they say is they know that their audience, especially dealing business to business, are sort of tech nerds. What do tech nerds like? They like kind of technical games, and they gave them a technical game, and what they got out of it were a bunch of business leads.
Now, when people were playing the game, did they know they were becoming a business lead?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's pretty clear when, especially
nothing's
for
free.
Well, right, and anyone who's technologically savvy, which especially is that audience, they know when you're giving your name and your company affiliation and other kinds of information about how big your company is. They know why they're giving that. It's for a lead.
What about Foursquare? How does that work?
Foursquare is a location-based game, essentially, although it's, is it a game? Is it something else? But Foursquare, you log in as you go to different locations. So Starbucks may, you know, people sign in as they go to Starbucks and you gain points each time you go. And so people compete to see who can go more often. And partly what they've found out of this is that people are encouraged to go more often to a place. They might have gone to Starbucks in the first place once in a while, but they go a little more frequently because they're competing with someone else to be the mayor of Starbucks.
Oh, okay. I've never played it before, so I've wondered why people were telling me where they were going and why that mattered to me.
Yeah, I don't know that it does matter to you, but you know, partly what they found in the social science of gamification is it affects your behavior. You see someone else doing something that earns them points, and you can't quite figure out why they're doing it, but you don't want to be second place, do you, Anne?
So all those farming games and all that stuff, those are all a form of gamification?
It could be, although gamification is usually described to apply to things that aren't pure games.
Okay.
You know,
they
gamified
it.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, you know, really anything that is a game already, you don't need to gamify. So it's more about gamifying other sorts of behavior.
AON, the insurance company,
yes,
developed a game as part of its Pass It On campaign to spread ideals.
Right.
How does that work?
So this is another sort of business use that's interesting, especially if you think about something like AON, big, you know, a big insurer, multinational. How do you teach people across the world the same sort of values, what the company is all about? And most of what they did are just sort of simple, you know, community service projects and other things that they would probably have done anyways, but they attached points to it and had regions compete with each other. So North American offices could compete with South American ones to see which ones were, you know, doing best on this Pass It On campaign. They also had trivia questions, and of course the trivia had to do with either how to do their business or what the company is all about, or, you know, what year they were founded, that kind of information. But it was a way of passing on the information that Anne cared most about its employees knowing across regions of the globe.
So that's something they actually worked with employees, and it was employee development. So HR, human resources arms of companies are involved in this.
That's right. I mean, it's being used all across all sorts of fields.
Right.
From, you know, hospitals to business to healthcare to education.
Why would it ever become, what did I say, a two-point whatever billion-dollar business? I think I said that at the top of the hour. $2.8 billion market by 2016. What makes it a market? What makes money from it?
I don't know that it's so much that it makes money as it is that people are spending money. You know, we talk a lot in our company about how distracted the world has become. And, I mean, everyone knows this. Facebook and Twitter and TV and the internet and email and everything else going on in your life. It's more and more crowded. And how do you get people's attention? So I think what you're seeing in that number is more about companies spending a lot of money because they know it's hard to attract people's attention. They know games do attract people's attention. So it's a way of capturing their attention for whatever it is they're trying to achieve.
And if you can capture people's attention, that's worth a lot of money these days.
Well, that's true. I mean, whatever your goal is, whether it's to make money or whether it's just to teach them the latest medical technique or education, you know, that is worth a lot.
So Deloitte cited it as one of the top 10 technology trends for 2012. Do you think it'll last? What do you imagine?
You know, I think the game, I think the jury's out a little bit. I think that it's going to survive as a big trend for at least the next couple of years. And after that, we'll have to see how effective it is. I think with most trends, people get overexcited about it and try and apply it to all sorts of things. And what you find is sometimes it works and sometimes you have a good situation for it and sometimes it doesn't. And I think maybe the heat will drop off of it at some point. But I think gamification will be around for a long time. Just like, you know, Mary Poppins has.
Right, and the spoonful of sugar and whistling while you work and all of it, right?
Sure.
Same diff.
Sure.
All right, Rob Messenger, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Rob Messenger, he is Director of Research and Projects for Mindset Digital. Coming up, Steve Fox from PC World will join us to talk about something that I'm curious about, the Nexus 7 tablet. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This year, the 4th falls on a Wednesday, but fear not. We'll bring you your weekly hit of the political junkie a day early. There's lots to talk about, too, from Charlie Rangel's retightened congressional primary to political fallout from the healthcare decision. I'm Neil Conan, political junkie Ken Rudin with guest host John Donvan. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. 84 degrees in downtown Columbus, mostly sunny skies today, warming up to a high of 94. There's about a 30% chance of a shower or thunderstorm, and a heat advisory is in effect until 8 o'clock this evening. Partly cloudy for tonight, a low of 71 degrees, still that chance of a shower or thunderstorm. For Independence Day, partly sunny and another warm day with a high of 95. And again, that slight chance of a shower or thunderstorm popping up.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Google has rolled out the specs on its new Nexus 7 tablet, and so far it has received mixed reviews depending on where you're coming from. So joining us now to talk about that is Steve Fox. He's editorial director and vice president of PCWorld.com. Welcome, Steve.
Good to be here, Ann.
I mentioned that it's received mixed reviews. Let's talk about the plus side first. And for starters, the cost, under $200. How are they doing that?
Well, you know, there is a whole new bunch of tablets. These are these 7-inch tablets, and that seems to be this kind of magic price point, you know, $199, $200, $250 if you're going to have more RAM in it. So there are several tablets now that have come in right around that same price, which is that's the competitive sets. You've got the Nexus 7. You obviously have the Kindle Fire, and that's a $200 tablet. That is, you know, by most accounts, the number two best-selling tablet around. Keep in mind the number one best-selling tablet, which is the iPad, you know, dwarfs it in numbers. Mm-hmm. But then you've got the Note tablet, and that's about $200. You've got the Galaxy Tab 2.7, Galaxy Tab 2 and 7.0 is the version of it, and that's all. That's $250. So, you know, we have a bunch of 7-inch tablets at this price point. What's interesting about what we're seeing from the Nexus 7? It has certainly on the specs side, as you look at it, mm-hmm. It's really packed. It's got much more. It's got better specs. It has it's faster. It's smoother. All those kind of things. It's also a little bit thinner, and it even weighs a little less. And I'll sort of mm-hmm. give you the comparison there. The important thing to note here is this is really Google's first stab at a homegrown tablet. Right, you know, most of us don't think of Google as a hardware company. Obviously, they're a rather brilliant software company, and we use their products all the time. And there's Android, the operating system, which appears on other people's phones and tablets and the like. But here, they're doing an Apple, right? Mm-hmm. They're really tightly integrating the hardware with the software. The question is this meant to be sort of a model for other manufacturers, a guideline, or is this the serious competitive stab that they want to win this market? I can't really be sure of that, but this is very clearly a competitive tablet, and probably the best of these 7-inchers right now, despite some drawbacks.
My guest is Steve Fox from PCWorld.com. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about the Nexus 7 tablet Google just rolled out. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can go to the Facebook page and post your question or comment there as well. And you can tweet us at Ann Fisher WOSU. So But let's go back to the price point a second. They're mm-hmm. doing it to compete with, but how are they affording to do it? Because you said it's loaded. I mean, there's a lot to it. How can they afford?
Yeah, one of the things that we saw early in the year, we saw it's called a reference model, which was, that was built early, that was, here's how you build, a tablet and pack all of this stuff in and, somehow do it at a cost competitive way. You know, it's not clear what kind of money that they would actually make on this. I mean, keep in mind that not making any money on it yet because it comes out in July. But mm-hmm. the reason why we really know about this is because there was a big conference last week, Google I.O., and they had, thousands of people, many of them, paying to attend. The journalists, journalists don't pay to attend, but all the developers and other people did. And then at the end, they handed out something like 6,000 of these to, one to each attendee. So clearly they were not making money on that part of the deal. But it certainly bought them, a lot of press because everybody got to play with these. It does look like if you think about, say, Amazon, they feel that they will make money, from what I understand, they'll make money because people will consume content of different sorts and they'll buy it from, say, Amazon. In the case of Google, this device is very tightly tied in to what's called Google Play. So that's where Google puts all of their content in there and applications and other things that you can buy. And there you start to see the glimmer of a decent profit model, right? Because there are, movies, there's music, there are applications and what have you that are all within Google Play. And so, there's a good chance that people who have this tablet will end up consuming the content and buying it from Google. everyone knows about, you know, the whole razor and razor blade idea that you don't make money selling the razor, but mm-hmm. you make it on the razor blades. And, you know, in fact, what you see on a lot of these devices is that the razor blades are the content, because that you can keep on adding more content. You have to replace it. You get new stuff. It was kind of funny. You know, we got the tablet, you know, back in our offices, and it comes preloaded with a few things. So some magazines, a few songs by Merle Haggard, songs by Coldplay.
What does that say about the demographic there? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, well, exactly. We were Transformers: Dark of the Moon, which I don't know if you've seen it, but. Well, I don't recommend it highly, but,
yeah,
you know, that was
yeah.
the movie that was on there. So they had obviously, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out who exactly is this consumer that they were thinking they were going for. But, you know, maybe it was just the stuff that they could get for not a whole lot of money to put it onto the device. But I think people will be certainly using this. The best thing about this device is the way that it's used to view and consume content. That's really, I think that's its focus here. And the other thing you want to think about here, if you're using, if you spend any time using a tablet, whether it's, you know, a Kindle or an iPad or any of the Android tablets, the form factor and the weight is really very important. You're holding these things, and so they're getting smaller and smaller. And the mm-hmm. 7-inch size is kind of interesting because it's really something you can hold in one hand quite easily. And you know, the weight on these things, you know, if you look at the Nexus 7, it's about 12 ounces. Now, that at least technically puts it in first place as the lightest of the seven inch tablets. I mean, you know, you've got like the Tab 2 from Samsung is a tiny bit heavier. Frankly, you know, you're not going to be able to tell the difference.
I was going to say it's we're talking 7 tenths of an ounce and things like that.
Right, that won't matter. But you know what's interesting is that when you get to something that's 2 ounces more, that seems, you know, 2 ounces. Who could care? But believe it or not, when you hold something that's 2 or 3 ounces heavier in your hand, you can tell the difference, and there is a slightly more fatigue. Certainly, when you're moving up to something like an iPad, which is, you know, closer to 1.4 pounds, there's a big difference there. Of course, that's a bigger screen, and mm-hmm. you know, magnificent, you know, both in colors and resolution and all of that. But, you know, when I walk around with my iPad, I don't hold it for long periods in one hand reading. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work in the same way. So I think this 7-inch size, and keep in mind we've got phones that are almost as much as 5 inches, right? And you've got these 7 inches, and then you've got 10s and 11s. So there's a whole range of tablet sizes. 7 seems to be one of the sizes that people, or certainly manufacturers, are settling on as being pretty convenient, pretty good for reading. It is. I will tell you, it is definitely big enough to be able to read. You don't necessarily need to squint.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually quite decent for watching movies, these 7-inch things. And I was skeptical, so I have to say that having done it. Yes, it absolutely does work.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher and my guest, Steve Fox, Editorial Director and Vice President at PC World. We're talking about the Nexus 7 tablet, which will be rolling out next month, but we're talking about it now because they just rolled out the specs on it and dished up, what, 6,000, you said, Steve?
Yeah, there are 6,000. So if you're in certain areas, I will tell you that, you know, in San Francisco, you know, near where the conference was held, there's a lot of people walking around with these at this point, you know, because I guess there's probably a certain sort of, you know, bragging rights that you've actually had one. You've gotten one at Google I/O, which is this big show they do. And by the way, it is a show. One thing Google really knows how to do, they know how to create drama. It was completely choreographed at the Google I/O show, unrelated to this Nexus.
Uh-huh.
I'll just tell you that the part that got everyone oohing and aahing is they had 4 parachutists.
Wow.
come down and land on the top of the convention center, the Moscone Convention Center in San Francisco, while wearing these glasses, the Project Glass glasses,
oh,
these Google
yeah.
glasses. So they were transmitting live from the glasses you know, perched on,
oh my
on
gosh.
Their on their heads as they came in and landed on the convention center.
So you could see what they were seeing.
You could see exactly what they were seeing.
Wow.
Of course, and everyone else, you know, a lot of people in San Francisco, we're all kind of amazed by this. But what really got us is we're thinking, how did they manage to navigate the San Francisco police permit system to allow this one to happen?
Good old-fashioned politics, probably.
Yeah, exactly. So that was the Google I.O. show. And then at some point after they'd done the Google Glasses, you know, the Project Glass and everything else, and they rolled out the Nexus 7. The other thing they showed, and that is very important as part of this, it's the new version of Android.
Yes, the Jelly Bean,
and,
right?
Yes, it is called quite ridiculously Jelly Bean.
I agree.
But then again, it supplants or is the successor to Ice Cream Sandwich.
Yeah.
So you know, it's hard to say that it's actually a sillier name,
right.
Though it might be. But this is version 4.1, so it's not you know, a major change. The thing that we saw with Ice Cream Sandwich, it was a pretty major change. This is a very nice set of tweaks. The reality is most people don't even, who have Android phones, do not yet have Ice Cream Sandwich. So this kind of does a little jump ahead. This is the first device that has it. And what we see when we look at Jelly Bean, it's really smooth. Everything just works really nicely. All the animations are very sharp. I mean, keep in mind, this device itself, that's, you know, that the that Android sits on top of, has got a quad core, a serious engine in there. Its CPU is pretty serious, but they have absolutely optimized Jelly Bean to take advantage of all the power of the device. So there's some pretty impressive things when you get to actually play with and look at the device. You can really tell it's sharp. It's quite crisp. Plays well.
If you're deciding on the Nexus 7 tablet, by the way, it's not going to be available in a store. You can't go to Sears or someplace to buy it.
Right, that's right. Who knows if they end up changing distribution models at some point. But yeah, you'd need to order it online. And,
right, which means you can't fiddle with it before you buy it.
No.
You can't check it out.
You cannot. And I think, their argument here might be, hey, it's $200. That's not nothing, but still clearly it is a, you can get a very good sense of it, based upon the specs. And certainly online, journalists and developers and everyone else are playing it to death in order to write about what their experiences are.
Yeah, there's no shortage of material out there. So they'll compete clearly with like a Kindle,
right?
The Nook and all of those.
I mean, the obvious competition here is the Kindle Fire, and of course, Kindle Fire draws a certain amount of heat, pun intended, because it is a very specific version of Android that was kind of just tweaked for the Kindle Fire, so it doesn't have all of the apps that you might get. The screen resolution isn't all that high. It doesn't have a camera on it. I mean, there's a lot of things like this that are somewhat irritating about the Fire. Nonetheless, it is, it does continue to sell, and it has wonderful ties into, the Amazon database of pretty much all the content you could ever want. So, that's the primary competitor here. But, then there are also, other things like the Galaxy Tab 2, the Nook tablet, which is really from Barnes & Noble, which is tied into the Barnes & Noble ecosystem. See, everyone's got their ecosystem.
Right.
What you tie into and that everyone's trying to sell you content. So that's the competitive set. I think there's a feeling that at $200 or $250, there will be people who will buy tablets like this just kind of to try it out. It will not be – it's not going to be anyone's primary device. That's just not – not part of the thinking on anyone's part, because if you had only this, you wouldn't have enough. You would absolutely need more.
So a couple issues. One thing, I read a criticism that Google isn't really rolling this out for a long-term proposition, that it's just sort of a one-shot deal and they'll see how it goes. But it's kind of like buying the wrong car at the wrong time. You're stuck with it, even though they're not making them anymore after a few years.
Right. Well, I mean, and you know, it's hard to know what their philosophy will be moving forward.
Right, because it's the first time with this, yeah.
It is the first time. And, you know, my thinking here is I do think that in some ways this is a reference model. This is a wake-up call to the other manufacturers. I mean, look, we look at this market, and what we see is lots and lots of people have come out with Android tablets. Some of them, you know, some small ones, larger ones. They are not selling. There's one tablet that's selling. And, you know, there's a reason for that. You know, Apple has done a fabulous job with their tablet. And it all works well together. Android, on the other hand, has a problem what's called forking, which means that the Android operating system, everyone creates their own sort of tweaked version of it. So you don't have the consistency. Some things work, some things don't. There's so much competition out there, and no one knows, you know, what am I supposed to buy? And the prices are all over the place. And in the meantime, you know, the Android tablets are getting absolutely trounced in the marketplace by the iPad. And then you have a Microsoft announcement 2 weeks ago where they showed a amazing-looking tablet called the Surface that will run essentially Windows. So I think, you know, it's very important for Google here to say, okay, guys, other manufacturers, you know, Android is important to us. Here's the way you do it. This is our example. You know, maybe they ultimately become, you know, the dominant player in this Android tablet market. But, you know, I suspect not. I think it's more likely that other people will look at this and maybe even go to school on it. Say, okay. Here's what we do next.
One quick issue. Google Play content is pricier. I mean, if that's where they're going to make their money, it is pricier, which is kind of a turnoff for some people. Than the Kindle content.
Right. Although, you know, you could also argue that if you look at iTunes, you will often pay more for content there than you might if you're going to go to, say, Yahoo and download a tune or eMusic or various other options. I mean, I think the pricing is the kind of thing that might well be in flux. You know, keep in mind they've got all this material there, but they have no users getting it. When they get more feedback, Google has shown that they are a highly adaptable company. And so, I would say that is true, that right now it does look like, you know, marginally they're a little bit pricier on some of this content. But I would not be surprised. You know, the market does amazing things as this competition. So, you know, as we look at that, let's see where this comes out moving forward. I'm definitely looking forward to watching it.
All right. Well, Steve Fox, thanks for joining us today to tell us about it.
All right, this was fun.
All right, Steve Fox, he's editorial director and vice president at PC World. Coming up, Russell Holley from Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, if you're barbecuing fish and it slips through the grill, what do you do?
Do you have a cat? Because that cat's going to eat well. You're pretty much done. At that point, you've sacrificed the fish to the charcoal gods.
Advice from Bridget Lancaster and Jack Bishop of America's Test Kitchen. Join us.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. As a basic member of our station, you'll receive a one-year subscription to Newsweek magazine, our airfare program guide, the WOSU FYI e-newsletter, and a WOSU grocery tote. A basic membership starts at just $60. Visit WOSU.org and click Donate Now.
Support for 89.7 comes from Nationwide Insurance Picnic with the Pops. The Columbus Symphony is cranking up the volume this weekend as they perform the music of Led Zeppelin alongside a full rock band Saturday, July 7th at the Columbus Commons. PicnicWithThePops.com.
86 degrees in downtown Columbus. Mostly sunny skies today, warming up to 94. There's about a 30% chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
As Steve Fox mentioned earlier, the Google I.O. conference was last week, and joining us now to talk a little bit more about that is Russell Holly from Geek.com. Russell, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Ann.
Hey, this was a major event. We were talking about a little bit earlier, a major event for Google to show off some of its new products. We just talked about the Nexus 7 tablet in the last segment. So what were some of the other products that Google unveiled at the conference last week?
I think one of the biggest things that Google did last week was they talked a lot about their document editing service. They have this Google Drive, which allows you to really kind of have a web-based, office suite. You know, it has word processing and you know, spreadsheets and all of those things. And for the longest time, it's been really great on the PC. If you have an Android phone, it works pretty well on that. If you have an Android tablet, it works pretty well on that. But they opened that service up as well to the iPhone and the iPad. And that was a pretty big deal to give, you know, Apple customers the ability to work with this technology as well.
So Google Drive, tell us about it. What's so great?
Well, it's a 100% web-based word processing suite. So imagine you've got, you know, your everything that you do in, let's say, Microsoft Office, but every file you've ever created, every document, every spreadsheet, it's all saved with your Google account. So when you create a document, there's no need to delete it because it's stored, you know, with the storage that you have with your Google account. From there, you can invite multiple people to work on the same document if you're, you know, trying to fill out a spreadsheet. The most common use it gets in my house, amusingly enough, is actually the grocery list. Everybody in the house can kind of jump onto the same document and fill out when they've either picked up stuff or take stuff off. But really for you know, an office or, you know, productivity environment, you know, anybody can collaborate on the same thing if you invite them to participate. And now you can, you know, you can do that same thing from just about any device in the world now.
Okay, so Google Docs been around a long time. Well, long in terms of the way we usually talk about long. But Google Docs been around. There's nothing new about that, but it's the number of devices you can work from now.
Right. And the idea behind Google Drive is that it kind of took Google Docs and gave it a lot more storage and a lot more power and a lot more people that can interact with it. So Google Docs and Google Drive are really kind of the same product now, but it just supports a lot more interaction from a whole lot of different devices and a whole lot of different, you know, kinds of connections.
So how does it look? Like, I can use it on my iPhone, right? So if I want to get into my Google Docs on my iPhone now, I can do that.
Absolutely. You just go right to the App Store and you look for Google Drive and it'll allow you to install it. And if you already have documents in Google Docs, they'll all be there. You'll be able to access all of them. You'll be able to edit all of them from your iPhone or your iPad, and you'll be able to interact with anybody that you invite to share that document with.
That means I really will have to work 24 hours a day.
You know, it's almost, it feels that way.
Yeah, it does. So what does it look like? I mean, have you looked at it on these different devices? Have they done a good job of formatting it for them? Because, Facebook's having a hard time with that.
It's definitely something that I use all the time, and it's a lot easier to use on, you know, the phones now, you know, especially if you've got an Android device. It makes it a little easier because you've got a little bit of flexibility with your keyboard. But with the iPhone, really, it does everything. You know, it feels really intuitive. You know, if you need to copy and paste something, you can, you know, long press and copy an area just like you would if you were copying text on another screen on the iPhone. If you need to edit something, it's very simple. They did a lot of work to make it feel like you don't have to really think about how you're doing it. You just touch and you know, it kind of knows what you're doing.
You mentioned in one of your blogs that the most curious announcement to you was the introduction of Google Now. What is Google Now? And what about it piqued your curiosity?
So Google Now is really kind of an interesting thing. It's not the easiest thing to explain yet. It takes all of the information that Google has kind of been collecting on you. You know, the information when you search for something, it keeps track of that. When you you have emails and you have messages and stuff, and so it takes all that information that it has been using for a long time to kind of give you the best, you know, kind of advertisements and stuff like that. And it's actually turned it into kind of a personal assistant. And it's a little jarring at first when you use it because, you know, the first thing you do when you turn it on is you see some, you know, kind of innocuous stuff. Like you see the weather in your area and you think, well, that's really nice. But then you also see, you scroll down a little bit and you see that it knows where you are and it knows without you having to enter the information in that you're maybe 25 minutes from work. And it takes a look at the path that you normally take to work, the roads that you normally take to work, and checks to see if there's any traffic on those roads. And if it sees that there's traffic on those roads, then it'll tell you, hey, you might want to take another route this way. There's, you know, 20 minutes of traffic on that road, so you're going to be late. And it just takes all of this information and kind of puts it into these you know, really useful contexts that don't require you to give it information.
So that's kind of Big Brotherish, isn't it?
It can be seen that way. And it's, I mean, Google Now is certainly something you can turn off. But the thing to keep in mind is that this isn't information that you haven't already given Google. It's just presenting it in a way that, you know, gives you, it just gives you context. You know, if I'm in an area that I haven't been in before and I want to look at, you know, a restaurant that's nearby, you know, if I've searched for sushi places over the last couple of weeks, then one of the first things it's going to recommend is that there's a sushi place down the street. You know, it just takes the information that you've already provided it and gives it context. But it definitely, the first couple of times you use it, it definitely is a little jarring because you have to think about it for a second and think, you know, how is it possible that Google knew this information about me? But it's all stuff that you've provided it.
Okay, we got a tweet from James. I'm not sure if it's related or not, so I'll just throw it out there. He asks if you've used the app Avocado.
I'm not familiar with Avocado.
That's the first time anyone's ever asked you something that you didn't know the answer to, Russell.
You're absolutely right.
You have to mark down this day somewhere. So, no, James, he doesn't know it. So you stumped Russell Howley. We'll have to check that out. All right, so it's going to be able to track everything that I do. Again, this is an app. This isn't automatic.
It's something that's built into the latest version of Android, but you have to turn it on. You have to give it permission. You know, there's a lot that goes into using Google Now. It's not just, you know, it's not just spying on you and giving you, you know, kind of weird information. But if you allow it to kind of take a look at the things that you do in your daily life, it really does give you some really interesting things, especially with calendars. I found that when I put a calendar invite in for 4th of July, for example, I was going to, you know, my uncle's house for a 4th of July party, and it actually tells me, based on the last time that I went there, when the best time to leave is for traffic, and, you know, just gives me a bunch of, contextual information for that event.
And it knows all of this. This is stuff that other information it's gathering from other places.
Right. Well, it's stuff that it's gathering from information that you know, Google has from, you know, Google Maps and Google Calendar and Google Search, but it's all information that I've provided it by being a Google user.
Okay, so let's turn to something else that might have popped up, I guess, the Nexus Q. What is that? there are pictures online of this little black orb. It's hard to tell exactly what it does. Why would anyone want one?
So the Nexus Q is an interesting thing, and really it is Google's approach to communicating with your television in, kind of a social way. So if you've got a bunch of friends over and, you know, you all want to listen to music or you all want to, you know, watch a YouTube video or something like that, instead of hooking a device up to the television or taking one of your phones and hooking it up to the television or taking, you know, another personal device and connecting it to a television, the Nexus Q exists as something that anybody can interact with without giving the television or without giving that device personal information. So basically, if you're connected to the wireless network that the Q is on, you can send a song to it, and it will grab that song from Google's library and play it. So your phone isn't responsible for playing the song. Your phone isn't responsible for any of the hard work or battery life that would go into continuing to play those songs. It all happens on the Q.
Have you been able to test that out?
I have, actually. I've got one sitting in front of me. And it's pretty cool. It's, it's an interesting concept. I don't think it's a complete thought yet. I don't know that it's something I would recommend to somebody to get yet because it doesn't have, it's hard even to explain it, to kind of describe what's going on right now when I'm telling it to you. But really, it's, it's kind of a powerful music player, you know, and it does YouTube videos and videos from Google Movies, but I don't think a whole lot of people are buying movies and TV shows from Google Movies yet. They're still kind of using Apple TV and Amazon for a lot of that stuff. So, you know, but the service is there if people are already using the services, and it's kind of a value add. But the biggest thing that it's really useful for is music. And the device itself is pretty powerful. It has a 25-watt amplifier actually built into it and you know, can really, you know, generate a lot of, you know, very good music.
So when's it going to be released and how much is it going to cost?
It's going to be $299 and it's going to come out within the next 2 weeks. It's available for pre-order right now on Google's website alongside the Nexus 7 tablet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really, you know, in my opinion, this is a gadget for, you know, kind of Google's hacker, you know, kind of core of users, you know, because this has got a lot of stuff in it that people who want to mess around with this kind of device are really going to appreciate, whereas somebody who just wants a music player may feel that $300 is a little expensive for it.
I guess I might as well ask you, what did you think of the Nexus 7?
I'm definitely a big fan of the Nexus 7 because I've not been a big fan of Nexus tablets for a long time. I do like that the iPad is very practical and very useful, but, you know, regardless of whether it's iOS or Android, I've never been a huge fan of Nexus tablets because they don't feel particularly portable to me.
Hmm.
Whereas the Nexus 7 is something I can slide in my back pocket and I can go and do things. And if you're looking for something that is great for, you know, maybe reading the local news or just kind of casually doing something that you could do on your phone, but it would be better to do on a bigger screen,
mm-hmm.
then for $200, you really cannot do better right now than the Nexus 7.
Hmm. Like Google Docs and or the whatever you call it, the Google.
Yeah, Google Drive is a perfect example. Or if you want to, you know, listen to music while you're on the subway, or if you wanted to, you know, watch a movie while you're on an airplane, you know, or just read a book from you know, your Kindle library or anything like that. I've enjoyed all of those things on this so far.
So anything else from the event, the conference last week?
There were a lot of little things from the conference last week, including one of my favorite things, which is 3D printing. This actually came from the developer sandbox, not so much Google itself, but one of the developer partners for Google.
Uh-huh.
There is a company called Cubify that was there, and they make what I have seen so far as one of the least expensive of the 3D printers that you know, really does a good job, you know, as far as actually, you know, creating things and being, you know, as functional as some of the bigger, way more expensive 3D printers. And this thing was, you know, it fit pretty much on a coffee table. You know, it was, you know, really not very big at all. And it didn't generate a lot of heat. And you could give it instructions wirelessly or with a USB stick. And it printed very fast. I was very impressed with it. It was only $1,300.
What's a 3D printer? What are we talking about there? I mean,
okay, so we talked about this a while ago. 3D
Yeah, I know, I
can
still get it.
So, essentially, you have this plastic filament, and it goes up into a feeder that kind of heats the plastic filament and dots it on this metal plate. And the computer that's inside of it keeps track of where that plate is and actually continues to build these little plastic dots on top of each other until it has a solid three-dimensional object that when that plastic cools, you can actually pull off of that plate and have a three-dimensional plastic object that you have created from a three-dimensional image from your computer. So you can actually build a three-dimensional image on your computer, and
uh-huh.
this will take that and physically print it into a you know, a real life three-dimensional object.
Okay, so when you're talking about designing it on your computer, is it sort of something on your computer that you would design as if you were designing it, you know, in the olden days on a drawing table, and you show the dimensions and the, you know, things like that on it?
It's a similar concept.
Okay.
There are 3D modeling tools that work very much like, you know, blueprint software.
Okay.
Or you know, drafting tables. Basically.
Right.
You know, it's the same basic concept, but it's a lot easier to do now. You know, there's a lot of 3D modeling software, you know, that you can give basic shapes to certain things and create things without really needing that kind of advanced, you know, drafting CAD experience. And so
okay.
you can take that information and you can plug it into even a website. There are websites that do it. and feed it right to the printer as though you were printing a piece of paper. And in 20 or 30 minutes, the Cubify printer will actually have printed that three-dimensional object.
It only costs $1,300, and really that doesn't sound like a lot, but is it expensive to operate? In other words, does the resin used in it, is it expensive to, I mean, an ink cartridge is bad enough.
Well, it really depends on how big of something you're planning on making on a regular basis.
Okay.
In the times that I've spent with 3D printers, I have found myself making everything from, curtain rods to forks. I mean, it's one of those things where I kind of sat down and thought, why would I need this? And
Yeah. There
are a lot of just kind of one-off things that are really fun to make, even when you're not just making, little toys and goofing around. The printer cartridges for the Cubify are about $50 a piece, and they hold enough resin for you to make, five or six, devices that are probably, between 4 and 8 inches tall.
Okay. All right.
Which is a lot when you consider how often you would use something like a 3D printer if you weren't printing something in mass.
We do have a question from Arlen on Facebook off topic. What type, if any, higher-end games can an Android OS run, say, StarCraft II or Star Wars, The Old Republic, etc.? Because higher-end games are the one thing holding me to Windows-based operating systems.
Yeah, I mean, Apple's iOS and Android's tablets aren't really designed for high-end games. So when you talk about something like Diablo III or Star Wars The Old Republic, that's something that's still very much resigned to Windows devices or, Apple's Mac line of laptops. That requires a lot more power than tablets are going to be generating anytime soon, with exception to the upcoming Microsoft Surface tablet.
Paul emailed us with a resolution to the burning question of the Avocado app. It's apparently a way to stay connected with the most important person in your life. It's a couples app. So
because avocados grow in pairs.
Do they? Is that it?
That's clever.
How do you know that? I mean, that is random, Russell. That is so random. You didn't know what it was, but you know why they named it that way. So
I get why they named it that after the description.
Yeah, it's like
avocado for growing pears.
It's like whispering sweet nothings in your partner's ear from miles away. It's a private space just for the two of you to collect and share life until somebody gets into it. Nothing.
Yeah, I'll have to take a closer look at that. I'm not entirely sure how useful that would be, but
yeah.
Maybe I can talk my wife into playing with avocado with me. I'm not sure.
Okay. All right. Well, did you see the guys parachuting in at the conference?
Yes, I was there for that. That was really kind of intense. and Project Glass is something that we've talked pretty briefly about before, and it was really great to see that particular project take shape. And we're not going to see anything concrete. Like, I'm not going to be able to have my hands on one until early next year.
Yeah.
But it is definitely something that they're very clearly dedicated to.
Well, Russell Holly, thanks for joining us. I hope you have a great holiday.
Oh, you as well.
Russell Holly is a tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks to the Allside staff. We had a busy morning today. Associate producer Amy Jurevich, Allside's intern Corinne Gleckler, Allside's volunteers Rachel Ramey and Andrew Sweet, and also with video production by Rich and Amber Karsmiski. Thanks for listening. This is Allside's with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.